From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. The public beach was closed today at Grand Isle, Louisiana, south of New Orleans, as globs of oil washed up on the shore. For weeks now, we've been hearing about the environmental impact of the BP oil spill, but it looks even worse close up. My co-host Melissa Block has been out on the water off the Louisiana coast with two organizations that are assessing the damage.
A fast boat ride down the Mississippi out into the Delta, where the river empties into the Gulf of Mexico. Silvery mullet leap from the water. Snowy egrets, a startling white, lift off from thick green marsh grasses. We're about 50 miles northwest of where the Deepwater Horizon rig exploded and sank 1 month ago. And just this week, oil has started washing ashore in this part of Plaquemines Parish, an estuary called Passe à l'Outre. It doesn't take long before we see the damage.
You can see every place where the oil has touched the reeds and the marsh, it's dead. It killed instantly. You can see all of this normally would be green right now is just all brown and dead. And at the base of it is just a black, gooey oil clinging to the bottom of the reeds. Pretty nasty.
P.J. Hahn is the director of the parish Coastal Zone Management Department. He reaches to pull out a stalk of roseau cane. It's coated with oil.
So sad when you look around here and you just think of what was here, what's happening to it now, and what's going to happen to it, you know?
What do you think is going to happen to it?
Unless we stop that oil out there, it's just going to continue to keep coming in here and wipe out everything we have. I mean, that's the reality of it. You know, a lot of BP doesn't want to talk about that part, but I can tell you right now, there is so much oil that's sitting out there. 4 weeks later, it's starting to wash up in this amount. We will not be able to keep up with this when it really starts hitting us. I think we're just starting to see the first wave of what's really coming, and what's really coming, I think, is going to be devastating.
We head out into open water, and soon the surface gets an iridescent sheen, and then...
Yeah, here you can see it.
Well, this is just filled with these rust-colored blobs floating on the surface. It smells stronger, doesn't it?
Yeah, a lot stronger, yeah.
The boat is surrounded by thick red clumps, streaks, and swirls of oil.
This just makes you sick. I mean, you look out here and, you know, how anybody can look out, you know, and say that this area is not going to be impacted. It's just outrageous.
Who's saying that this area won't be impacted?
The president of BP said earlier this week that there will be minimal impacts because of the oil. And you can see already how much damage just this little bit has done in here. Not a little bit, this is a lot of oil, but this is little compared to what's out there getting ready to hit us. And we know it's coming, we just don't know when. And that's the scary part.
Another boat, another venture into the Gulf.
That's an oil rig, an offshore oil rig.
And over there?
That's another oil rig, another oil rig, another oil rig, another oil rig. You'll see more.
We're with biologist James Harris with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
We're leaving Baptiste Colette right now, entering into Breton Sound.
We're heading north to the Chandelure Islands, to Breton National Wildlife Refuge. Established in 1904 by Teddy Roosevelt, it's the second oldest refuge in the country, a thin, curved string of barrier islands. And environmentalists are anxious about this refuge, which is nesting ground for tens of thousands of birds. We pull up to North Breton Island.
James, that island looks like it's just alive with birds. They're just everywhere.
Oh, it is.
Out there.
They are packed in there. Yeah. Just shoulder to shoulder.
Brown pelicans stand like sentinels, dignified and huge. Terns and gulls wheel overhead with black skimmers and oyster catchers joining in the dance. We splash our way onto the island. It's ringed with three layers of protective boom, which so far has kept the oil offshore here. This is peak nesting season, and this rookery is considered so precious, so vulnerable, that Fish and Wildlife made sure this island got the boom first. It's in the direct path of the oil spill. James Harris has been working at the Breton Refuge for 20 years now, and he has a particular fondness for the brown pelican, the Louisiana state bird.
It's special. Brown pelicans were a symbol of Louisiana, that they were this charismatic bird that was so symbolic of so many things coastal.
And symbolic of what's at stake in this fragile ecosystem, the brown pelican had completely disappeared from Louisiana by the 1960s. DDT was largely to blame. It was listed as an endangered species. But then young pelicans were transplanted to these islands, brought in from Florida. Workers fed them painstakingly by hand, and gradually they recovered. Now there are about 3,000 brown pelicans on this island alone.
We went from a bird that was, again, totally absent from Louisiana to one that is now off the endangered species list. It represents the return of a coastal symbol. I talk to people that remember when there were pelicans, remember when there were not any pelicans, and now they're seeing them again, and they are thrilled that they're seeing pelicans again, and not just ones and twos, but in large numbers.
I would imagine, though, it's a personal thing for you. You've worked so hard with these populations. It could all be threatened right now.
It is personal. These are not my birds. These are not my islands. But when you've spent that many years working with something and getting to know it, you can't help but feel an attachment to it. Just a really neat bird.
What would the worst-case scenario be, James, for this island, these pelicans, all
worst,
these birds?
Worst-case scenario would be oil moving in on a storm, because then it would overtop the boom, overtop the island.
How worried are you about the real threat posed here? What could come in, especially if there's a big storm?
How worried am I? The longer it goes on, the more concerned I get. Because right now, up to this point, the tides, the winds, everything has been in our favor to keep it out of here. But of course, we're getting into storm season now. So the longer it goes, you know, you're pushing that envelope.
And just down the beach, there is an ominous sign of what could follow. A dead brown pelican, its wings and neck coated in oil. Officer Raul Sanchez with the Fish and Wildlife Service has put the bird into a thick plastic bag, and he fills out an evidence seizure tag to go with it.
That's basically evidence, so I have to make a chain of custody.
The pelican is taken away for necropsy. It could be used as evidence in a criminal or civil case against BP. So far, the dead bird count has been fairly low, in the dozens, but the fear is many more birds are dying at sea and won't be found. For everyone here along the Gulf, there are way too many unknowns. How much oil is out there? Where is it moving? How much longer? As one wildlife official told me, looking out over the Gulf of Mexico, I just want them to turn the faucet off. In Louisiana's Plaquemines Parish, I'm Melissa Block.
The Cannes Film Festival, that bastion of sand and cinema, draws to a close this weekend. Critic Kenneth Turan has been in the south of France, taking in all the movies. He's on the line from Cannes to talk about this year's festival. Hi, Ken.
How are you doing?
I'm good, and I bet you're having a good time.
The weather's good. When the weather's good, you can't complain.
Well, let's start by talking about one of Cannes' more mainstream offerings this year. Director Oliver Stone's sequel to his 1980s film Wall Street was Wall Street worth revisiting?
Yeah, well, they put a new title on it. It's called Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps. And it was okay. You know, I mean, there's so many arty films here that to have one of these big, juicy Hollywood movies here where everyone's kind of licking their chops and bad guys are being evil, it was kind of refreshing in some way.
Now, I know both Woody Allen and British director Mike Leigh had films at Cannes this year. And from what I've read, they weren't exactly uplifting movies.
Well, I think that's true, especially with the Woody Allen film, which is called You Will Meet a Tall, Dark Stranger, and follows several couples in London who are unhappy in their marriages and their relationships, and things just go from bad to worse with them, and it's really not a very happy film in any sense of the word. The Mike Leigh film, though, is really something else. Mike Leigh is a director who works in kind of a very singular, unusual way. His last film was Happy Go Lucky, but he's probably best known for Secrets and Lies, and he goes very deeply into character, into you see people on screen being alive and human in ways that no other director can really manage. And he follows really a couple here and a friend of theirs through the course of a year. And you just see kind of what life does to them, what happens to them, how they react to life circumstances. And it's a very rich, very involving film. Very, very moving, actually.
What other feature films should we be watching for coming out of Cannes?
Fair Game is one of the more interesting films here. It stars Sean Penn and Naomi Watts. This is Doug Liman's film, telling the story, you know, ripped from, you know, not today's headlines, but kind of yesterday's headlines, the story of Valerie Plame Wilson and Joe Wilson, who got involved in the buildup to Iraq. And, you know, her career was as a CIA agent was outed for political reasons. And it stars Naomi Watts and Sean Penn. And it's a very involving film. It's a very interesting. It's not just a political film. It's a film that's kind of engaging about relationships, about the marriage between these two people and what getting caught up in the Bush White House shenanigans really did to them.
Now, I know documentaries were also being shown in Cannes this year. What documentary should we be aware of?
Well, I think the best one here, I think most people would agree, is called Inside Job. It's made by a man named Charles Ferguson, who did a film a couple years ago that was Oscar-nominated called No End in Sight, which was a look at not why we invaded Iraq, but what went wrong once we got to Iraq. So he's very good at analyzing things that have fallen apart, and he's a PhD in political science. He's an academic. He's not a usual filmmaker. And in this film, An Inside Job, he looks at the financial collapse, at what went wrong with all the stuff that happened over the past couple of years. And for people who don't think they've really been able to understand it, don't really know what happened, don't really know who's to blame, this film really lays it out in really good detail. And it's quite fascinating, quite astonishing, and really, I think, it's as riveting as kind of documentary work gets.
Any idea who's going to get the awards when they're given out this weekend?
Boy, it's hard to know. You know, I mean, awards are, unlike the Oscars, where the same people vote every year, every jury is different. It would be foolhardy to guess. People guess every year, and they're always wrong.
And Tim Burton's heading the jury this year, is that right?
Tim Burton is heading the jury this year, and, you know, he is, in general, a person that's not easy to figure out. So what he's going to go for and what he's going to lead the jury to are really hard to say.
All right. Well, thanks, Ken.
Thank you, Lynn.
Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times.
That music can only mean one thing. It's time for our video pick of the week with Flora Lichtman. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
Our multimedia editor is here with another great video.
Thanks. It's I think it'll be a fan favorite because it's an animal cam.
Ah, always video. A fan. Already.
Yeah.
Don't have to know what animal
yeah,
it is.
Exactly. This week is about the secret life of the red-eyed tree frog.
And how do you find these?
You know, the credit does not go to me, obviously. How did these scientists find these topics?
Say it one more time. The secret life of the red-eyed tree frog.
That's right. And you've probably seen a picture. Most people have probably seen a picture of one of these guys. They're the really bright green frogs. They've got blue on their sides and, as the name suggests, those really beet red eyes. And
so they're not the rare things you're never going to see. These are.
I mean, they're like National Geographic's favorite. You know, they're really pretty and really cute in the light of day.
But what's their secret?
That's right. So Michael Caldwell went to Panama, and he had heard that these tree frogs have this mysterious behavior where they shake. There was this old paper 40 years ago. Some scientists had written about this, and he studies them, and he had never seen this. So he's looking at them under all types of light, and then he finally decides to go out at night and use infrared video cameras. And suddenly, he discovers this whole other side of these tree frogs. And what happens is they're very territorial. So one tree frog is on a bush, and it really wants its bush to be its bush.
Right. I'm not sharing this branch with anybody.
No, exactly. Right. And to fight over that, there's sort of this whole sequence where first they start out with the calls, these vocal calls, and then it ramps up this communication between these two male frogs, and they start rattling the branches.
Like shaking the bodies.
They shake their bodies.
And we have a video. You have the video of them actually in nighttime, the night scope vision version of them shaking these branches. And you only can see them at night and only now on your video on our website at sciencefriday.com.
Yeah. And apparently it's not just kind of aggressive. It's actually a really specific form of communication they found out, because they put little accelerometers, these sort of really sensitive microphones, on the branches. And they found that every time that the frogs do this, no matter what frog it is or how big it is, it's shaking it at the same frequency. 12 hertz is the magic, you know, angry shake of the frog.
12 times a second.
That's right.
You have to shake it or else it you know.
Right. And then it signals that it's a wrestling match is about to begin, which you can also see in the video.
So if you want to see these frogs shaking the branches.
And wrestling
in the middle of the night. And it's interesting, because their eyes sort of light up in that
infrared
light.
It's very creepy.
This is not a cute one. This is a creepy one.
It's a little bit scary, yeah.
You can go to our website at sciencefriday.com and click on our video pick of the week up there on the left side. You can also download it on our podcast on Take It With You on our iPod podcast. So this is something different this week.
Yeah, it's different. And, you know, the thing that the researchers stressed was that we don't think about vibration as a form of communication, maybe because we're not that sensitive to it. But, you know, they think that maybe this is sort of more meaningful than we've given it credit.
And thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
And if you want to see that form of vibration on our website, as I say, go to our website at sciencefriday.com, and you can watch this video, Pick of the Week. That's about all the time we have for today. Our program is produced by Christopher Intagliata, and senior producer Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Alicia Bayak is our Spanish language producer. Neil Rausch, our technical director, pushing the levers over there. Up on our control panel here in New York. And we had help in Second Life from Lynn Cullins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbin, and University of Denver. Surf over to our website. We have a new survey up there. Please go to our website at sciencefriday.com and press the survey badge on the right side of the screen, a little check mark there. We'd like you to take our survey for us. And also, as I say, you can take this show and shove it right into your pocket by downloading our iPhone app right there on the website and from our webpage or from iTunes. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel, and here's a measure of the economy today. Time was, if we had five law students from a highly ranked law school, five people about to collect their law degrees and enter the job market, their prospects would typically make us feel at least a twinge of envy. First-year associate jobs that pay more than most people make deep into their careers, or prestigious clerkships or interesting government jobs before going to a law firm. In any case, a solid course toward repayment of all those student loans. Well, the recession may be technically over as far as the economics department is concerned, but for graduating third-year law students, even at Georgetown University Law School, the economy looks pretty bleak. And that's where our guests are from. And why don't the five of you introduce yourselves?
My name is Becca Richardson.
My name is Joel Florescu.
My name is Aaron Rowden.
My name is Jessica Bogo.
And my name is Jason Lewis.
Let's begin with Becca Richardson. Why don't you start by telling us what you'd really like to be doing next year, what you thought you'd be doing next year, and what you actually will be doing next year?
I will be going into the government next year, and I'm actually pretty excited about that opportunity. But it isn't something that, if you had asked me 10 months ago, it isn't something that
I thought
I would be doing.
You wouldn't have said, I'm looking forward to working in the federal government after I
come out of law school. Well, I wouldn't have said that I'm looking forward to working where I am working in the future because I didn't know it existed. So,
why don't you tell us what agency you'll be working at?
I'll be working for the Federal Mine Safety and Health Review Commission, which is a very small independent agency.
Joel.
I had planned to get involved in international arbitration or maybe tax law. I also had some of an interest in labor law, but that's not going to happen. It seems that next year I think I'm going to join up with a friend of mine who already has her own small practice in California and just see how that works out.
Aaron Rowden, what did you look forward to doing next year and what do you now expect to be doing next year?
Well, when I first came to law school, my hope was that by this time I would have a job somewhere in the area of world trade, probably working for a non-governmental organization, maybe a firm. However, since those things haven't happened, I'm returning to the state of Maine so that I can run for the state legislature for District 84.
So you'll be able to run and say, I know what it's like in this economy to be looking for a job and not find one.
Certainly.
Jessica Bogo, what had you expected for this year and now what do you expect?
Well, I went to law school just wanting to become a practicing litigator. I ended up working for a firm over the summer and loved it and would love to be working with them, but the economy the way that it is, we have a fellowship where we're working with a nonprofit organization for the first year. So for my first year out of school, I'll be working with the Volunteer Legal Services Program with the San Francisco Bar as a federal litigation attorney. So I still get to do what I want to do.
So explain this. You've been given a job by the law firm.
Yes.
But that job won't begin for another year and a half after you leave law school.
Right.
Jason Lewis, what about you?
Well, I left a PhD program to come to law school. And I don't know what I necessarily expected my job prospects would be, but I certainly thought I would be making, you know, six figures first year out. That is not going to be the case. Right now, I'm still sort of uncertain what I'm going to be doing after graduation, but I'm very strongly leaning towards the idea of just hanging out my own shingle and giving it a go as a solo practitioner.
I'm curious, all of you, generally, how many jobs have you applied for in this,
Hundreds.
In this year? Hundreds.
And I think that's probably the case for all of us.
Mm-hmm. Certainly.
I've sent out at least 150 resumes and cover letters.
Joel?
I have to say that we five on this panel are a bit unrepresentative of the legal industry as a whole. I think that for a lot of the schools below us, it was a struggle for a very long time. Now their struggle has become our struggle. Now we have to deal with the same sort of problems that they've been facing. And we're not representative of the entire class of 2010. We're in a top law school.
Mm-hmm.
And just because we are struggling now doesn't mean that everyone else has had it hunky-dory for the past 10 years.
Georgetown typically rated at least among the top 15, if not the top 10 law schools in the country as the ratings change from year to year. So Joel's picture is a very pessimistic one, and I wonder whether that's one that the others among you share, or does this feel like a bad bump in an otherwise straight road that will work out well in the end? Jason Lewis.
I think that a lot of the real problem that's happened to the legal profession is that now we're suffering because the economics of the large law firm just doesn't work. You know, I think that's why you've seen not many of the firms have gone under, but one of the things that I hope that does come out of this is a restructuring of it. And maybe law students are going to have to realize that coming out of law school after a three-year education and expecting $160,000 a year is just not a realistic business model.
I do think that our generation, be it our year, the year behind us, and maybe the year in front of us or something mm-hmm. like that, I think we did kind of get the rough end of the stick just because – we didn't know that mm-hmm. the economy was going to take a downturn when we signed up for X number of loans every year. And if the economy does turn around, which I'm optimistic maybe because I have to be, but if the economy does turn around and law firms start hiring again, they're not going to hire us. They're going to hire the classes behind us who are coming straight out of law school, who they can train up in the way that they always have.
Because this is a career in which you get on the escalator at a
yes.
particular time in a summer when you're at law school, and they look you over and you look
yes.
them over, and then you
law firms generally don't hire you out of government or out of, you know, being a private practitioner. They generally hire you straight out of law school or from another comparable firm.
Does this feel to you like some piece of terrible economic weather that's hurting us for a couple of years, but, you know, the sunshine will come out, maybe we'll be set for a loss by it, but things are going to return to something like the old normal? Or do you feel that what's happening right now is some fundamental change in the way we live, support ourselves, and think about work? What do you think, Jessica Bogo?
What I think that the current economic climate has given us is an opportunity to really look at who we are and what we want and make sure that what we bring to the table is valuable. And so being able to really assess and make sure that what we are offering is valuable, I think, is a change that will be good going forward and I would hope would stay.
Well, Jason, what I think is we might actually end up looking at two separate legal economies. The one that is the big firm economy that we have now, it's not going to go away. But because you're going to end up with, you know, probably 5 years of lost attorneys, hopefully those attorneys will be able to innovate and will be able to create, you know, something that's different. Now, it's not going to replace the large scale law firms, but I think it gives us the opportunity to innovate, to create new ways of doing legal practice and legal services.
Well, good luck to all of you. And thanks to all of you for talking with us about your situation.
Thank you.
I'm talking to a third-year Georgetown University law students, Becca Richardson, Joel Florescu, Aaron Rowden, Jessica Bogo, and Jason Lewis.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. Scientists report this week they have created what they call a synthetic form of life, a cell that is in part natural, part man-made. And the man who made the cell is here to talk about it. That would be Craig Venter, who says he has created a synthetic genome. At a press conference yesterday, Venter said the new bacterial strain was, quote, the first self-replicating species we've had on the planet whose parent is a computer. The work, though, is not without its critics. Friends of the Earth, an environmental group, denounced the work, saying Dr. Venter has, quote, taken genetic engineering to an extreme new level, and that Dr. Venter should stop all further research until sufficient regulations are in place. What do you think? You can join our conversation at sciencefriday.com, or you could tweet us at SciFry. Also, you can give us a call, 1-800-989-8255. Let me introduce my guest. J. Craig Venter is the founder, chairman, and president of the J. Craig Venter Institute in Rockville, Maryland. He joins us from our NPR studios in Washington. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. Nice to be with you.
Thank you. Let's talk about what you've actually done. You took the genome from one cell and put it into another strain of the same organism. Would that be wrapping up?
Well, that's what we did in 2007.
Right.
This time we started with the digital code from reading the genome in the computer, mm-hmm. and four bottles of chemicals, and chemically made the over 1 million base pairs of the genome. It was finally assembled in the eukaryotic cell, Saccharomyces, which is the brewer's yeast. We then isolated the bacterial chromosome from the yeast cell and transplanted into a bacterial recipient cell. After it was transplanted, it took over the cell and transformed that cell into an entirely new species dictated by the synthetic chromosome.
Did you have to take out the chromosomes from that cell first?
No, we didn't. Years ago, we thought we might have to do that. We think there's one of two possibilities. When the new synthetic chromosome goes in and starts being read, some of the genes that are initially expressed include the restriction enzymes that my friend and colleague Ham Smith got the Nobel Prize for in 1978. We think they recognize the chromosome already in the cell as foreign material and chew it up. So we have the cell of one species and the chromosome of another. And as that new synthetic chromosome gets read, it starts making all the new proteins coded for by that chromosome. And then that cell turns into the new species coded for by the chromosome.
Mm-hmm. So basically you created the same cell again that already had existed?
So we copied, in this case, heavily from the Mycoplasma mycoides genome, the one that we'd been working out all these transplant experiments mm-hmm. with over the last several years. Because if you can imagine, 99 out of 100 of our experiments haven't worked, and this has been almost a decade of complex problem solving to get to this point. So we wanted to start the experiments with something that we at least knew would be compatible with life.
Mm. And how do you react to some of the criticism that I read at the beginning, that this is a little bit too dangerous at this point?
Well, we expected, even though we've been raising issues and discussions on this since the 1990s. In fact, the first bioethical review was published in 1999 before we did the first experiments, and that's a review that we had asked for. We were concerned that despite all the discussion, there's over 100,000 blogs on the internet before this publication, that still this would be the first time the majority of people heard about this research, and we figured there would be some of the usual shock and responses to it. So it's not anything new to the molecular biology community and mm-hmm. people trying to understand something new and complex and having knee-jerk responses. The fortunate thing, it's less than 1% of all the responses mm-hmm. that have mm-hmm. been out there.
And in fact, some of the more well-known members of the molecular biology community, I'm just going to quote one of them, David Baltimore, who's a Nobel Prize-winning geneticist at Caltech, is quoted in the New York Times today as saying, "To my mind, Craig has somewhat overplayed the importance of this. It's a technical tour de force, a matter of scale rather than a scientific breakthrough."
Well, David's entitled to his opinion, but we haven't played up the importance of this at all. We've described what we've done. Mm-hmm. It's other scientists and people around the world that are attributing what the importance of this breakthrough is. This is something we've worked 15 years on. It's a very critical milestone in our work and our ability to do things. And I think it is an important milestone in what can be done in science.
Well, tell us what the practical applications might be.
Well, what we started out 15 years ago to do was to understand a minimal cell and to understand what those genes do in a cell. Despite all the knowledge that we supposedly have in the biological and scientific community, we do not know anything about the complete components of even the simplest bacterial cell. We don't know what all the genes do. We don't know which ones are essential, which ones aren't, what makes them essential. So here we're trying to understand the human genome that my team sequenced 10 years ago, and we yet do not understand the simplest bacterial cell. The goal was to create a synthetic chromosome so we could vary the gene content, understand what was important, understanding whether gene order was important. It had very basic science components and motivations. It's clear over the last 15 years of thinking about this research and other people thinking about it, it's a new tool set that has a number of potential applications. When we started out doing this, nobody knew how to make even a 5,000-letter piece of DNA accurately. Now we're making a million base pair pieces of DNA accurately. So we had to develop a lot of this technology over time. And that technology, the first thing people will probably see possibly as soon as next year is the flu vaccine that you get could come from these synthetic processes.
Mm-hmm. And so it's possible with this bit of advance of technology to tailor make then a bacterium that will be a factory for something you want to make.
That's clearly the hypothesis. And the reason for that is when you look at what's been capable from existing molecular biology techniques and anything that we know about that's out there, including all the GMO crops that Monsanto and others have, less than a dozen genes have been changed in any commercial product to date. It's a big deal even changing a few genes. It took DuPont $100 million in over 10 years to make a dozen changes in E. coli to go from sugar to making propanediol.
So now you think you might be able to just dial it up in the computer? Like you said, the parent of this was a computer.
Well, it's not so trivial.
Tailor make the genome and stick it back in a bacteria.
If biological knowledge was sufficient to do it on first principles, yes, but we're not there yet. So there will be definitely a lot of empiricism with this, which is why it's important to get to a minimal cell, understanding what are the components that are absolutely necessary for life? And then can we add back components specifically that we want, for example, in the case of trying to make fuels from carbon dioxide to increase the efficiency of CO2 conversion into hydrocarbons that could go into refineries, as an example.
Mm-hmm. You went around the world collecting algae. Algae is a target of your research. I see from reading the articles that Exxon is prepared to spend up to $600 million.
It's definitely a target to try and see if it can be scaled up. If these processes can't produce the billions of gallons needed to start weaning us off oil, they're not going to have any impact. Mm-hmm. And thus far, there's not a single naturally occurring algae strain that we're aware of that has the properties necessary to get to that scale. Mm-hmm. So it's going to need genetic engineering. Whether the first strains used are just changing a handful of genes or not, it's not clear. The second generation and onward will all be synthetic organisms where we can control the 50-plus parameters to really get stable production of fuels.
Can we stop making vaccines with eggs?
I sure hope so. the synthetic genomics won't result in that change, but companies that we're working with, like Novartis, have a $300 million plant in North Carolina ready to go with MDCK cells to get much more rapid and better production of the flu vaccine. So hopefully the FDA will move us ahead two centuries now.
So it looks like this is a proof of concept. Basically.
Absolutely. That's the best description.
Yeah, that you can get this done. So where do you go the next step? What other next step and proof of concept do you need?
So, some people have made a big deal that we started with an existing cell. That's been part of the strategy. We're trying to build on top of 3.5 billion years of evolution. But one of the key questions is how far apart can the synthetic chromosome be genetically from the systems that are in the cell, the ribosomes to make the proteins. We need something to kickstart the genome. We don't know how few components we need, but we know we need to be able to make messenger RNA and have proteins made initially. That may be all it takes, because then the rest will come from the genome. So how far afield can we go? These are pretty close relatives. These are about the same distance as human and mice are. So they're pretty compatible systems. We need to see if we can do this with more complex bacteria, microorganisms, such as algae cells, to really affect things. Mycoplasmas are very simple cells, and you couldn't have described it better. And that's how we've described this, as a proof of concept. This organism wasn't designed to do anything practically except prove it's possible.
And so then you move up into more complex organisms and see if it works there.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much for taking time to be with us, and good luck to you in your research.
Thanks, Sarah.
J. Craig Venter is the founder, chairman, and president of the J. Craig Venter Institute in Rockville, Maryland, and he joined us from our NPR studios in Washington. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about stem cell research, not quite the same sort of research that Dr. Venter was talking about in this case, but we've heard a lot of news about stem cells. Where do we stand? What's the state of stem cell research? Are we going to see any real breakthroughs? Are there any things on the horizon? What about embryonic stem cells? Are people still talking as much about them as they are before? Are they still as valuable a product to work with? Or are people stuck on adult stem cells? We'll cover the whole waterfront on this. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Stay with us. We'll be right back talking about stem cells after this break.